This is a No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chat with guests, the Spring Standards. I'm your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond. For the best in Americana, alt country, indie rock, and more, point your browser to nosurfmusic.com.
Do you want Noah to come talk?
I would love Noah to come talk if he'd like to participate, or if he'd like to sit there and stare at his iPhone or whatever. That's cool too.
He rarely engages.
I see.
And it's by design. Because well, we don't like him to.
Yankees fans are antisocial.
Yeah,
I think we said last time, my whole dad's family is Indians fans, so we like from Mansfield. So
right. Something. And yet you're wearing a purple Yankees hat.
Sorry.
I mean, I'm sorry for you, actually, you know? I mean, you just need to realize that they're evil and accept that and move on.
He's got 26 reasons to like the Yankees.
27.
Oh, sorry, buddy. I've got one team that won one time.
We won in 1948, and we lost the World Series, so, and that's what this is all about.
Yeah, yeah.
So, that makes you feel better. Cleveland hasn't had a championship since the 60s in any sport. It's a sad, sad place to live if you're a sports fan.
Aww.
So anyway, everybody listening, welcome to another edition of No Surf Music, Burning River Fireside Chats. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond. And joining me today are the Spring Standards. And we're sitting out in a nice shady patch of grass outside the wonderful Beachland Tavern. And as we get started here, why don't we just go around right in a circle and have everybody introduce themselves and say hi.
Hello, I'm James Smith. How is everyone?
Hello, everyone. I'm James Clear.
Hi, I'm Heather.
Rob.
I'm Noah Goldman.
Yay!
All right, and like I said, they are the Spring Standards. And if you don't know them, you really should, because the Spring Standards are definitely an interesting group. One of the more eclectic bands out there on the indie rock scene right now, I would say. So, I have some questions just to start off with.
Shoot.
Just so people get an idea of who you guys are, because the three of you have known each other pretty much forever, right?
Uh-huh.
And you grew up, according to all of your biographies, in sort of a shady, nondescript area of the Delaware-Pennsylvania border.
Yeah, exactly.
I love the way that you guys phrase that. Like, don't really want to tell you because I don't want stalkers. But
borderline. We live in the middle of the borderline. The borderline's like 40 miles wide.
I gotcha. But I guess that would put you in the middle of a river, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But,
sort of.
Okay, so you guys grew up in a river. What was that like?
It was interesting. You know, Poseidon has his time there with us. He's god of the sea, but he trickles downstream sometimes.
I got you. Well, you got to take care of all the waterways,
exactly.
Especially the navigable ones.
Exactly. No, but the reason we always say the Pennsylvania-Delaware border sort of area is because we would always be on one side or the other. You know, if you're in a state with a bordering state, and when you're right on that border, it's like you go to the mall and that mall is 10 minutes over the line, and you know there's tax-free shopping in Delaware,
right?
So we'd always go there to do this and do that. So Heather was actually from Delaware, Newark, Delaware. James and I are from a small town in Pennsylvania called Kennett Square, which is literally, you take like a 10-minute drive on one certain road and all of a sudden you're in Delaware, you know. So it's really we share that border. So it's, we say that because that's the closest, best way to describe exactly
right.
where we live. You say Southeast
Pennsylvania.
Well,
because neither of us is willing to be a part of the, like, I am unwilling to identify as a Pennsylvanian.
Right.
And they're unwilling to identify as Delawareans.
Yeah, I'm totally
neither
a Pennsylvanian.
Neither of us
I'm not
are going to budge on the issue, which I certainly am as stubborn as anyone about that, because I'm very proud of being from Delaware.
Well, you should be.
Because you have to be.
You do. I mean, it's kind of like being from Cleveland. Like,
yeah.
You know, everybody dumps on Cleveland, so you've got to say fuck you to Yankees fans twice as
yeah.
hard, you know? But I actually have a very good friend from Newark.
Really?
Newark. And she would kill me for just mispronouncing
yep,
it.
Yep, I will.
So I have spent some time there. Sorry.
That's
I've also
cool.
am a very good
there?
Friend from
Newark, New Jersey.
Jersey, too. Yeah,
yeah
so... no. Well, she went to high school there.
Oh, all right.
And then we met when we went to Emory in Atlanta. Atlanta.
Oh, cool.
But I visited her there a few times, yeah. And it's a very nice little college town.
It is. It's
yeah,
very sweet.
It's reminds me a little bit of Kent here in Ohio. If you've ever
really?
Been there. Yeah.
No, I haven't.
Same kind of vibe. One of these days, you guys should play the Kent stage.
Okay.
But aside from that advice, so how did, exactly did That's you guys good. Meet originally? Was it because of music or?
No, sort of, actually. Half and half. These guys were neighbors, so they just kind of wandered, like, into each other's backyard kind of a situation, and being two young men of the same age were drawn together, naturally, and then they found, you know, music was something that they had in common. And then James Clear transferred to my high school. They had already been friends for a couple years, and James Clear transferred to my high school. And then we were just sort of like the go-to arts and music and theater kind of girl-boy counterparts.
Okay.
So we became friends because we were in all the choirs together. We both did theater, and we both were just kind of in the same circles. And then he invited me to come jam out with him and his sweet duo band and see what happened. That was when we were 15 or so. So that's how one thing kind of led to another. So music was definitely a huge force, but it wasn't like we met at a show or something. You know, it kind of was a budding friendship that then was further solidified by the shared love of music, I guess.
I gotcha.
You know what I mean?
So let me ask you two specifically, the Jameses.
Yeah.
Because as we saw there, it's kind of hard to tell you guys apart somehow. Obviously not when you're sitting here talking to you, but
yeah.
James and James, come on, tell me one of you guys never thought about going with Jimmy or something. I mean, you're in the same band, just to make it easy.
We call each other, I mean, it's, when I call him James, it's just like, that makes sense, it's his name, and vice versa, so it works for each of us. Heather and Noah have a harder time, you know, I think but very rarely they both sort of like Heather had started with, she'll be like,
we've got a bunch of nicknames
like
here.
Clear, Clearbo, Smith,
Dummy
Face, that's for me.
JC.
It's never been a problem. I've never ever
really
in the history have ever had a confusion with you. I think there's a conversational muscle that we all have just kind of exercised enough now that I guess if I was in a crowded room and I wanted to make sure that everyone knew I was talking to you, I'd call you Smith, but I wouldn't think about it. I just would because I knew that it was better for the public conversation or whatever. But sometimes I'll just be like, hey, James, even amongst these guys.
Right.
And he'll turn his head or whatever, or one of them will call for me instead of him, and I'll turn. And I'll just know who's being talked to. But we've never ever had any stumbles. It's weird. You think there would be. I have on sports teams. I've played on sports teams in my life.
Uh-huh.
I've had to, you know, go by Jim or Jimmy, or they just start calling me that anyway. It's more sports friendly,
right?
You know, if you're trying to pass the puck to someone or throw a ball, it's like, hey, Jim,
right? Yeah,
you know, or whatever.
Seems a little more manly that
it
way.
Sounds
you
more
know?
Manly.
I mean,
so I guess since we're like sort of like, you know, kind of poopy artist types, we have to go with James. We have no choice, really. That's
I got
really
you.
All we have.
Well, I totally understand, but let me tell you, as a music reviewer, it gets a little annoying trying to figure out how to refer to
everybody
you
everybody gets around it by making the tongue-in-cheek joke of the like the other James or like James number two. People, they always come up with like funny, like,
right.
They have two Jameses. They like love to talk about it.
Yeah, it's
you
fodder.
Yeah,
well, it's because there's only three people in the band, at
right.
least as far as studio work is
concerned.
It's three people and two names.
It's
right.
It's hard because, like, it's my name.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, my name isn't Jim. My name isn't Smithy. My name isn't all these names that people give you. My name is James. It's what my parents call me. It's all my close friends call me. No one calls me Jim. So, it, like, to shorten my name would be not my name.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So it feels so weird if that was
well,
the way.
Well, I mean,
James
people
is,
call me
you
Diesel,
know, the
so
same
I completely
thing.
Understand.
You
it's what
like,
you want. It's like,
you know, I mean, those people, exactly. And so you know, it may be tricky, but it's like, I would just be, I wouldn't respond or, like, if someone was like, hey, Jim, I'd be like, you obviously have no idea who I am.
Hey, Jim.
You don't know me because I would never let, I don't want people calling me. So it's very like, you know, I think James is the same. It's like, we're just James.
Right.
Our name's James, so why call us anything different? Like, if Heather's name was James, I'm sure she'd feel the same way, and that would be truly annoying, you know? But it's just that's just the way of it.
There's some girls with the name James. There's that supermodel, James King.
Oh, yeah.
That
big.
Would be kind of an interesting way to build a band, however. It would,
what's
you know,
that?
It would be an interesting way to build a band.
Yeah,
you know,
you'd
have
go.
That little
three,
extra
yeah,
three James
yeah.
thing
three
going.
Is, call ourselves the James Gang. Oh, wait.
Yeah, I think that was, that one might that be was taken. And
we should really consider this.
That was
maybe
a good Clevelander, so don't knock it.
Yeah.
Gotta love Joe Walsh around.
Damn right, man. I love him.
So, speaking of Kent State, that's where he went.
There you go. Check it out. He's doing that.
You guys then separated after high school, getting back to mm-hmm. your story, and then all sort of independently found yourself in Brooklyn, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, New York. At that point, we were mostly in Queens when we first moved.
Okay.
The greater NYC.
Now we're...
Yeah.
Yes.
There's nothing that great about Queens, if you ask me, but...
Although, there's parts of Queens that are very cultural. I sort of fell out of love with it personally living there. I liked it for a long time.
Okay.
It's a good spot to live when you first move to New York. There's
well, it's very diverse, which is the one bonus. I mean,
diverse,
you can find...
It's cheap. There's a lot of cool restaurants.
Down at all, even temporary routes. It starts... And that's why I left, because I was like, well, I'm going to live in New York for like at least half a decade more, so this doesn't seem like the kind of place I want to be doing that. I had a good time up until then.
Gotcha.
But Brooklyn is where we have, like, our final resting place is Brooklyn. In the New York area, we've all found our really comfortable neighborhoods where we live. And,
gotcha. And Brooklyn's a very comfortable place. I mean,
it is. Well, there's a reason a lot of bands live there, because it's a marriage of comfort and coolness. You know,
diversity, like, cool places to see, cheap stuff, relatively, unless you're in Williamsburg and then you're crazy. It's just artist-friendly, the whole thing.
Absolutely.
Makes sense.
So, how long after you guys all sort of found yourselves there did it take you to decide that this is what you want to do and you wanted to get together and form the band?
Well, I mean, we started playing music together again almost immediately. By the winter of, the fall when I moved.
I was already...
James was already there, like, doing stuff on his own. By, December of the year that James and I moved, like, we were playing already, not as the Spring Standards, but with a fourth member as Old Springs Pike. And, like, we, it was, at that point, I would say that the decision to pursue the actual sort of career of touring musician, recording musician, didn't happen until we became the Spring Standards. At least I can say that for me personally. And I think that's pretty true as a group. I had moved to the city, me personally, I had moved to the city to pursue acting, and that was kind of my main focus. But when we became the Spring Standards, that became my main focus. And it was like, okay, this is the career that I'm going to focus on. And I think that was a moment that we all felt. It was a big fork in the road kind of moment. Because it's a huge commitment. It's a gigantic commitment. You don't, I guess you can sort of casually start touring, but you don't casually continue touring, realize pretty quickly, this is an entire lifestyle that I have to either make my peace with and commit myself to or stop doing, So, it's been about 5 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think that actually is an interesting point that you make about the touring, because, I was sort of on the Williamsburg to Lower East Side, back and forth, New York indie rock trek for quite a while, and I know a lot of those bands.
Yeah.
And a lot of them have sort of decided that their path is to stay there and to play all of those clubs and to make it there. So, as a New York band, you sort of decided to step out from the common path of the bands in the area and get out and tour the country and find fans elsewhere before you tried to really solidify yourself there. Was that a conscious decision? Was that because of the kind of music you play?
I think it was semi-conscious. There's only a handful. You're totally right. There's not a lot of bands from that New York indie band scene that actually get out on the road at this stage, meaning, not just big enough to already have a bus and people demanding you in every city, like just to get out and try it. There's only a handful. I mean, a lot of our peers are in that category. A lot of them aren't, but a select few are of that sort of hybrid of like you're a New York indie band, but you're also a touring band. It's sort of a silly combo, because if you're a touring band, you'd want to live in the cheapest possible part of the country, so when you're not touring, you can go and like pay $100 rent or something somewhere.
Right.
But it's cool because you do get that sweet combo, you know, like a flying in stereo kind of vibe. Like when we're back at home, we're like working the scene. We're like, you know, going out to the clubs and sitting in with our friends and being part of the community. And then when we're out on the road, it's like, you know, we say we're based in Brooklyn, but most of the time, I mean, we're based in the van. Like,
right.
Wherever the van's parked is where we are or whatever. So,
So I'd like to introduce you to Cleveland's own Spring Standards, ladies and gentlemen.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, because on the road, that mentality kicks in. And you're right. A lot of New York bands just hang out in New York. And it's unfortunate because there isn't a lot of mandate for bands to hit the road because it is tough and financially. And also, it's just tough with time and finding a way to get in at clubs now without an agent and finding a way to manipulate a tour and to have enough gas in a van to do it. Like, it gets to a point where people don't want to take that chance anymore, but it really is like the old way, and as antiquated as it is, and as you know, you only get a finite amount of people added each night when you play a different place. It's you get far more people on the internet every day than you do when you tour around, but it still doesn't change the power and the potency of like appealing to people in the live environment for the first time. And the only way to do that is to tour at this level, so there's a chance people might still see you and not maybe know who you are, or maybe just have been recommended by a friend. But, you know, like, as compared to, like, if you hit the road once you're already big and you've got that big album on the almost, or the, on the, you know, the big TV show soundtrack or whatever, so everybody knows who you are. And then once you hit the road, you've got a bunch of people that already kind of, like, know what's up. But if you can tell them what's up the first time live, like, that's
right.
Kind of the only, that's what's super unique about touring at this stage with, like, you know, with, like, not a super amount of wind under your sails, but just enough to get you from each town.
It's also a little bit of, I think, six and one half dozen of the other in that way, because if you were to not tour and stay like a New York band, mm-hmm. it's gonna be a different kind of slow climb, you know. I mean, we're like James was saying, we're slowly climbing through, you know, playing venues, getting a couple more people in the room every time we play a different city, you know, a couple more people at a time. It's the same thing. If you're a band in New York City and you just play New York City, you're going to be doing the same thing but as nationally. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
You're building your New York fan base. That's awesome. But at a certain point, I can imagine it has to plateau. There's only so many people in one city. I mean, a big city.
Right.
But then you're not necessarily growing your fan base outside of that city. So you're doing really well in New York. But then if you were to leave, you would need that one thing, like James says, like the internet or like some hit song on the something or the thing or the this, and it takes probably the same amount of time to do both those things. They're just two very different approaches, you know, at kind of the same speed, really, if you think about it, you know. We've just sort of spread ourselves out a little bit more, but you know, it's still the same kind of climb in New York, you know, waiting for that one opportunity that's going to come to you, as opposed to like putting yourself out there and going to those things. It's really just like, you know, Heather was saying, it's just a choice. It's a choice to do it this way. But it's... Yeah.
But I also don't think it was like... I don't think there was a moment in our first, you know, month of existence where we decided to define ourselves
about,
as one or the other.
No,
you know,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of a hindsight moment where you're like, oh, I guess this is the identity that we've grown into. You know, it wasn't, and some bands are very deliberate about that kind of decision.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that some bands are very deliberate about their image or their genre or their, you know, or just like the, you know, the aesthetic that they want to have. You know, from the first moment somebody hears about them, they, you know the font that they always use or the clothes that they always wear. And there's nothing wrong with that. And in some ways, you know, I feel like in the 5 years that we've been around, I'm like, huh. Maybe we, you know, maybe that's a good technique. Maybe that's something that we could integrate at some point. You know, it's like everybody's just trying to throw spaghetti on the wall and see, like, when it sticks, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of wisdom, and then there's a lot of luck. And I think that, you know, we just started touring because the first thing we got was an agent.
Right.
We had an agent before we had a band name, you know? And that was really lucky.
Yeah.
But so what we did is we hit the road and didn't really necessarily think much further than that. It's only now that we look back and we're like, man, we've been to every city in the country, just about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fucking awesome. And we've got friends everywhere. And that's fucking awesome, too. And I think, you know, you nickel and dime it any way that you can and what comes most naturally. And I think we're lucky that we tour well. Like, we don't kill each other. We don't... you know, make enemies of venues. We meet people and we make friends, and then people want to have us back. So I think you can make choices up to a certain point, but sometimes things just start to happen. That's the way that the momentum starts to roll, and you ride the horse that's running, you know.
Well, and I guess related to that and to people having you back, I mean, the first time I actually heard of you guys, and I've always tried to stay up with bands, but, you know, there's just so many out there, it's impossible.
Yeah.
But the first time I picked up on you guys was from the Haha Tonker tour sample. Haha Tonka tour sampler. Say that three times fast.
Yeah.
Or even three times slow if you're me right now. But, you know, just hearing a couple of studio cuts from you guys, and honestly, I don't even remember. I think Halcyon Days was on there, and maybe one other. But, you know, it was such a unique sound, and obviously I was going to see the Tonk anyway, but, you know, I thought it would be great to see you guys together. And,
yeah.
You know, interestingly enough, that was the first time I saw you guys, and it was April 15th of 2011. Which I remember exactly because, ironically enough, it was the day that No Surf Music was founded.
Oh,
so, well, yeah, part of it is because of the Haha Tonka Boys, and actually the first review that I wrote was for them before there was even a site.
Yeah.
And that day also happened to coincide with the internet poker crackdown.
Oh, yeah.
Which left me with a lot of free time. So I was talking to Brian, and we were just like, you know, man, this is just something I've been thinking about doing. I think I'm going to finally do it. So theirs was our first review, and you know, we didn't get to review that show, but I thought it was really interesting. So it's, you know, it's kind of a bit of a karmic thing that you guys are back here at the Beachland, and we get to interview you this time.
That's really cool.
So on the subject of touring then, this is your second time here, right? You hadn't been here before, had
we
you?
We had been here before.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
We had played the Beachland. One of our first big tours was with Glenn Tilbrook of Squeeze.
Okay.
And he played the big room, yeah. And
gotcha.
We opened for him here. I think it was like the first big tour that we were on. I could be wrong about that, but it was very early on, I think in the first year of our existence.
Yeah,
okay.
It was the first like month plus like tour where it was like shit.
Yeah, it was long. It was like 5 weeks.
Gotcha.
But it was awesome.
Yeah.
They were great.
He has a huge Cleveland sort of following. He wrote a tune about the Beachland.
Oh, really?
He's friends with
Beachland.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well,
and
who
it's
is
this
it?
Like trippy ass, like 60s psychedelic, like Vox organ, kind of Elvis Costello sounding, you know, but even more retro tune. And it's called the Beachland Bar. And it's like crazy, like, what's that dance, that 50s dance where they're like nosediving girls? It's like that kind of vibe.
Okay, I'm not the one to ask about 50s dances.
Yeah, it's like a
but,
50s dance song. I don't know.
I'm not the one to ask about 90s dances. I'm not the one to ask about 2000s.
Glenn Tilbrook has a song about this very place.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
Oh, we've played Wilbur's, too.
Wilbur's,
okay.
It's a sports bar. It's not even a
That's a funny little spot. So we've played Cleveland a handful of times.
Okay.
But
well,
it's not to your discredit that you hadn't heard of us beforehand.
Well, like I say, I mean, I try, but there's a ton of bands. And
yeah.
I mean, even doing this, you know, I just trying to keep up with the new releases and stuff as a music writer is damn difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just so much stuff
so
out
much,
there.
Yeah.
But I do, on the subject of new releases, want to talk about yours.
Oh, awesome.
So we're going to get to that now.
Great.
So first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
I thought the new double EP, Yellow/Gold, it's actually a double slash, right? So you guys had to play with the grammar. Was very interesting.
Thank you.
A couple of questions I want to ask you guys about it. First of all, I find the concept of double EP really interesting for a number of reasons. Number one, it kind of gives you that opportunity to do the sort of thematic split that you guys did. But number two, it kind of reminds me of a friend of mine, and you probably know who I'm talking about, who just did the same damn thing because you were involved with it, Lennon.
Oh,
that's right, yeah. But
he did a
double EP?
He did a double EP.
Oh.
He sang on half of it.
Yeah, I didn't realize there were two. I thought there was only one.
No, there were. Well, this is why I wanted to ask you, because
that bastard ripped us off.
It just came out first, so I don't know. You might have a fight in court about that one.
Yeah.
So those two ideas were not at all related?
No.
Okay.
Not at all related.
Because, I mean,
it's funny that you say that it's
it's sort of like a newer like thing, or like having a dichotomous split or whatever, but it's kind of like borrows from like side A, side B vibe.
Okay.
Like two separate sequences, you know, and then from there, even more polarized than like an old record would be.
Well, I mean, like bringing it all back home. You totally. Know, you got the acoustic side, you got the electric side, something
that
like that.
That would be a great example. Or like the White Album or something, where, you know, where you've got that, because we're just like.
Well,
Beatles,
that's four sides,
I mean.
So.
Yeah, that's
fair. Yes.
No, but yeah, but I mean,
so
yeah,
you're
the
Ringo,
idea
right?
of like separate entities with like an intermission in between. Like you're forced to take the disc out, put it, we package it that way so that, you know,
right.
you buy the actual physical copy. They're separate discs, even though you can probably fit it all.
Right, right. Well, actually, before we jump back into the album, then, that actually brings up an interesting question, which is, were you guys vinyl kids? You know, did you have a collection when you were growing up?
I always
had
a turntable.
I had my dad's collection.
Yeah, it was my parents, and then it grew into my own when I was old enough to, like, get one.
I gotcha.
I've been pretty audiophile style. Since college, I've had, like, a nice hi-fi turntable and, like, newer records as much as old records from my films and stuff.
I gotcha. So is that the main reason that you enjoyed vinyl, was the sound quality?
For me, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
For me, it's about the hi-fi frequency, welcoming back, rather, of these frequencies that were killed during the CD era.
Right.
I could go on all day. We should stop talking about this.
Okay. Well, I mean, I definitely agree with you. Like, that's one of the main reasons. And even, you know, just my respect level for people who put out LPs.
Yeah.
New bands who do, I mean, it's just automatic. It's like, you know what you're doing, you know what your fans want.
Everyone I talk to at the merch table now, or 90% of them, rather, it isn't about the audio quality as much as it is about if you're going to buy a physical artifact at all.
Right.
And it comes with a download card, you might as well get the vinyl, because it's a little bit more expensive, but you get, like, a real artifact, and you're going to listen to it on your MP3 player or your computer anyway. And so, like, to minimize the process, to not have to buy a disc and rip it yourself, you've just already got the high quality things on a download card. That's what people are interested in.
Right.
And so if you're gonna, you might as well get the bigger artwork. You might as well get like a thing that's really nice, and rest assured in your heart that you've got the highest possible quality audio if you ever need it.
And I think that's a whole nother level too, is the tactile thing. You know, the artwork is so much more beautiful, and the cardboard is just so much more real than the damn plastic CD holders.
That's my end of it. That's the end I personally love. I mean, I can hear the warmth of vinyl, and I appreciate it, but to me it doesn't make, personally, a big enough difference. Mm-hmm. But it's the tactile part that adds to it, that makes it just like this thing you hold. It's beautiful. You can look at it. It's like art in itself is a package, you know, and that to me is like where the weight lies. A lot of, you know, not all of it obviously, but that like pushes it over the edge to be like, I am a vinyl junkie.
Well, and especially with old records too. I mean, you don't get the same experience downloading an MP3 of a Woody Guthrie album as you do, you know, holding that
even
special,
like,
kind of paper that they used to use in folkways.
Even like Benny Goodman kind of stuff. It's like you get, you know, it's so different playing on a vinyl as an MP3. If you hear that stuff on MP3, you're like, this is a little too, feels crisp and weird.
Uh-huh.
You know, but when you hear it on vinyl, you're like, oh yeah. You know?
Well, if you have a good vinyl, actually the vinyl is crisper because you're unlocking way more frequency.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just like the warmth of the needle. You get actual like tones that are in there that wouldn't be in there otherwise. Especially probably with an older record. Like an old vinyl's not going to perish in terms of like the, you know, the frequencies, they're still burned in there. It's like it's physically burned in. It's the best. Like, it really is. There's nothing that can beat it. It's the smell. The fact that you can hear it when it's unamplified.
Uh-huh.
You can spin a record on a needle and not even have the amp on, and it'll still make noise. Like, that's
Well,
that's
CD amazing. Will make noise, but it'll just kind of make that as you're spinning it.
But that's I think that's highlighting the exact reason why there is no warmth in a CD.
Right.
Because there's nothing touching anything. There's a laser interpreting via line of sight. There's no actual touching. In analog, there's a touch of actual touching. So you're hearing warmth because there's intimacy. There's a needle's touching the thing. This disconnected, like, eyeball looking at a laser thing, like, it just doesn't, just conceptually, doesn't ring any bells for me. Like,
right.
You know, which
totally
isn't
understand.
To say I don't appreciate that CDs have taken us to the current status of digital music, which is, you know, lossless audio and FLAC files, and getting to vinyl status without having to put on the vinyl in terms of those frequencies that I'm talking about before. You know, now it's all, you know, CDs helped us get there, I think, but they were, you know, I'm glad they're on the way out a little bit. They're
Indeed.
Annoying. They take up room.
He was right. I shouldn't have gotten him started on that. No, but you're absolutely...
I straight up was just like, don't... Just
dude, no, no. It's fine because I completely agree with you. Yeah. I think it's something that people don't think about as yeah. much as they should.
Yeah, I know. Think a crazy alternate career for me would be being like some kind of a musicologist slash, you know, like technology update guy for like, I don't know, for the radio or something. And if people just listen to me blab on all day.
Well, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, I'm going to do it.
Okay, well, I won't hire you, but good luck with that.
See you guys. Have a good one.
Bye. So, James number two, as we decide, or was he, no, anyway.
No,
James is leaving, but the rest of the Spring Standards will stay to discuss their new album. And getting back to that, so it was this sort of dichotomous thing between the yellow and the gold. And I find it interesting because, you know, as we were just talking, you guys are a Brooklyn band in some respects, but you don't really fit in with the Brooklyn vibe of indie rock. I mean, you're definitely, especially in your past albums, much more of a, sort of a folk rock base with a lot. I mean, just you guys obviously have so many influences.
Yeah.
You're one of the more, especially live, I think, kind of eclectic groups out there because you can jump from one style to the other to the other to the other in successive songs and they all blend so well because it's still you. But on your earlier LP and EP, it was really pretty strict folk rock bass with other stuff on top of it. And this time, honestly, having spent some time in the Brooklyn scene myself, it seems like that sort of New York indie rock has seeped into your music a little bit more, especially on the second of the double EPs. Is that something that you guys, first of all, agree with, which it seems like at least Heather does?
Yeah.
But second of all, was that something that was conscious, or is it just because you've now spent so much time there listening to other people that they've influenced you?
Definitely we've been influenced by our community. You know, a big part of the creative process of making this record had to do with our producer, Dan Malad, who has been, you know, in the Brooklyn scene for as long as we have been, but in a much more sort of, you know, has been on the production side of a couple different, you know, significant New York bands, and has really been the driving force behind at least the recorded representation of them. You know, Via Audio is one really good example. They're really cool, like super hip kind of Brooklyn band.
One of them tried to cold cock me once, but that's another story.
Oh, yeah.
Another haha talk a story. But.
Yeah. They're all pals. Anyway, I won't be overly, you know, verbose about it, but I think that, you know, his involvement had a lot to do with that. I think it also has a lot to do with, you know, us finding our identity more. You know, and I think that being influenced by the music you grew up on is really significant. And then sometimes you have to be influenced by what's going on around you. You know, I think that the exercise of the two EPs, you know, we tried to sort of harness both of those creative energies and, you know, looking backward, looking forward, looking, you know, look standing still, and have all of those things sort of happening simultaneously to represent as best we can kind of the moment where we're at, you know, and I hope we never settle into one thing or the other, you know, and, it's interesting that you say that the full-length LP was, you know, Would Things Be Different, was pretty straightforward folk rock because we have kind of never heard that it was, you know, you're sort of maybe the first person to say, this is straight ahead one thing.
Well, I don't think that, I feel like that was the base.
Yeah. Oh,
more so, like,
certainly.
And then you expanded out. I'm not saying, you know, it was straight down the middle.
And I don't see it as a criticism,
right.
Actually. It's kind of interesting to hear, and it's cool to hear that. It's cool to hear that you picked up on the foundation being, like, one solid thing, and then there was growth from that. But part of the idea behind this double EP was in response to, you know, kind of what we'd heard from many different sources about, you know, from one track to the next, kind of what you were saying before about how much genre hopping there is, how different one song is from the next one, and yet they're all us. And so, you know, part of the exercise of this project was, well, what if we try not to do that? What if we try to create 7 songs that are all yellow. And that is obviously a very, you know, sort of expressionistic approach to put a color that there. How many different tones are there? How many different, you know, interpretations of that color are there? And even among the three of us, there were a lot of variations. So it's not like we limited ourselves excessively, but we tried to keep it under that umbrella. And the same thing with gold. So, you know, so to answer your original question, I definitely think that we are heavily influenced by the community around us, and I do think that that comes through more so in this record than in previous recordings. But we're embracing it. I mean, we love the forward momentum and the evolution. You know, I don't think you can make. Why would you ever? You know, I think it would be so sad to make an enemy of evolution as an artist. You know, you like have to do that as long as you're still being true to yourself. You know, you have to. You're always gonna be changing. You should always be changing. Yeah, so,
I think now we're also, you know, like whereas like, you know, you were saying like, you know, like we're not kind of like a traditional Brooklyn indie rock band. Now I feel like we are kind of, because there's this, you know, if you dig deeper, you just find sub chapters of hangs and scenes and places where people convene to play music in Brooklyn. And we've settled in this community in this neighborhood, Dimmes Park in Brooklyn, that you know a lot of our other friends live, including some of the bands we've mentioned and then some others we haven't. Just like there's, you know, maybe like 3 or 4 or 5 bands that all are kind of, you know, equally as like folky influenced as they are sort of like indie rock based. And we're, you know, I think we wanted to be like a Brooklyn band by staying there and not by like piecing out to go live in West Virginia or something and like hunker down like the Even Brothers or something. I think we didn't want to be like, you know, like Vampire Weekend or Sleigh Bells or like super, you know, crazy, like super cool. But at the same time, I think there's this like new, you know, thing that's coming out of Brooklyn that is very much cool and dark and indie and all that stuff that people are looking for, leather jackets and AC/DC shirts, but also like, you know, vocal harmony and stuff that's coming out of the new sort of like, you know, Fleet Foxes door opening moment, you know, like you can sort of like live in that world and still be like, hey, they're totally a Brooklyn band, but it's happening sort of inside out for us, I think. It's just now all of a sudden I think it's easier for us, and with the new EP too, new double EP, I don't know, for some reason I feel like worlds are colliding a little bit. And I feel it more when we leave the country and people are like, where are you from? Oh, from Brooklyn. And they go, oh, all right, I know what you're talking about.
Okay.
And these are people that have already heard the set, seen what we dress like, everything.
Right.
And it rings to people, whereas maybe it wouldn't have a little bit ago. I'm proud of being from Brooklyn and saying that. And we all officially now do live in Brooklyn. So.
Well, I would say the new stuff, the double EP, if I walked into Pianos or Trash or Arlene's Grocery or something, and I heard that, I would totally expect it. Whereas some of your older stuff, it wouldn't be completely out of place, but you would be like, where are these guys from?
Yeah.
They're obviously not a New York band.
Maybe like Wednesday night at like 8:30 with a select crowd.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Right.
Whereas, you know, Friday night headliners could be Yellow Gold, you know?
Yeah.
No,
and
I
it,
mean,
it just seems to have a different vibe to me.
We made it in an apartment in Brooklyn, so I mean, it has every tone is saturated in, like, you know, the streets of Brooklyn kind of vibe, and it's like there, like everything sounds more raw, and there's more warmth from the creative genesis, the very tip of the iceberg, you know, because we were doing it with a friend in an apartment instead of like, you know, Would Things Be Different was a great record, but we did it with like a famous producer in a big studio. You know, and so it made all the world a difference for us to, you know, to try both of those out. You know, there's really no harm in either, or any advantage in either, at least from the drawing board. So we tried both of them out, and I guess, like, well, you know, only time will tell, but we're really super stoked about what we were able to do in a little apartment, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think it definitely turned out to be a very strong project.
Yeah.
With,
thanks,
you know, considering the way that you recorded it, especially. You know, a lot of depth to it, even more depth than your earlier albums, which is saying a lot because you guys always seem to have a lot going on. And you all sing, and you all play multiple instruments. So that kind of leads me to ask, you know, what exactly is your process when you guys come up with these songs? You know, obviously they germinate from one person and then you have to go from there, but you know, how much of it is usually conceptualized by each one of you, and what do you bring to the rest of the group before you go out and do it?
I write them all, I arrange them all, I do them all, I sing them all, I perform them all. Everyone does anything else. This is James Smith. Everyone knows I'm out of here.
Okay.
No, just kidding. No, I.
So that's one side of the story.
Yeah, that's one of them.
Now that he's gone.
Yeah.
Out of here. Don't listen to them.
It's we all write. We're all writers. So generally, this is how it works. I mean, if you were to average it out in a mathematical equation, one of us will write the song, you know, all the chords, you know, maybe lead lines, all that stuff. And then we'll bring it to the rest of the band, the other two, and then we will have more ideas about the arrangement, but we'll only have some ideas. Or a couple times it's been like very much like, this is how I think the song should go. What do you guys think? It's like, yeah, let's do it. But mostly, most of the arranging happens with all of us. One of us will write it, and then we'll come in, and then someone will be, ooh, what about this schooly line? Here's a bass part. What about... And the arranging of the actual melody and things comes out, you know, when we bring it all to the group. That's generally what happens, I would say. But we've also had times when that hasn't been the case, where one person brings the song, it's already completely arranged, it's already ready to go, and then we just sort of slot in. There's been other times where it's like we bring in, you know, a verse, a chorus, and then we need help with the second verse. Or, you know, what do you guys think about this bridge? And we're like, well, that bridge is like 7 years too long. Let's cut it down. You know, it's for the most part, one person writes. Sometimes there's co-writing, but that's, again, very rare. So it sort of happens like that for the most part, you know? We all have sort of an equal hand in it, which is part of the thing, I guess.
I think a thread line is folk music. Concept of how you write a folk song kind of spat out like our weird configuration and the weird way we do things. So I think the goal is for us to always have digestible music, like in terms of the music end of it. You know, so basically like keeping it simple and pure, and then making it really interesting for us to dance around and play different instruments and jump around and play the bass here and the drums here, but keeping it like it's like folk music. You know, in terms of the philosophy and the blueprints, it's like, you know, the lyric and the melody, often very complex, but usually we're working with just like grooves, like being tight and like, you know, having just a solid foundation. And it allows for us to then, you know, switch up a lot and do stuff where like, James, you play drums on this track. It's just like this quick little thing, or like, you know, I'll play bass and then we'll get some trumpet going or something, you know, and we can really work to our creative strengths sort of laterally. If like the overhead is like, yeah, we're just gonna like, you know, elaborate on a simple, like, but tried and true method, you know. And I think that happens without us theorizing. We can kind of reverse engineer it that way. That's one way to think of it. Is like, you know, we try to like let the interesting part of the arrangement, you know, be the combos in which we do stuff. And that's only able to be done because the music, as we write it, is kind of like. Of the right word, but just like kind of like manageable, digestible, and like and wholesome in a simple way, you know. And I guess it's like eating a really good you know, like piece of fruit, a basic piece of fruit. Like, it's the most amazing thing, this is the apple or something,
right.
You know, like I think that's kind of like what in our writing process, that's what happens. So if like James has a song, like he's saying, he brings it to the group, it pretty much stays close to what it was, you know. And what we do is just find ways to assign neat things to be done all at the same time, and now we've gotten to a point where we're really good at it, where like for Yellow and Gold there's stuff that happens only for 1 second in a song,
right,
and then like it doesn't come back until the end of that other song that sounds kind of like that one, or like, you know, there's multiple keyboard patches and a sampler and all these things that happen, but the song is still really thin and just comes in perfect kind of like here and there moments. So things kind of like got chronologically like more and more complex and interesting in the way we split things up, because I'm not so sure if we've talked about it, but we split up the drums. That's like our main thing,
right?
Is like splitting up the kick drum and the snare drum and the toms and the cymbals and splitting them up kind of democratically amongst the band,
right?
And therefore being in charge of not only the tones they make but the rhythmic placeholders that they represent, 1, 2, 3, and 4. It's not one person doing all that now. It's like one person doing the kick and the other person doing the snare, which means one person does the downbeat and the other person does the backbeat, and some people are in between. And so all these, like, you know, landmarks for Pulse that usually is falls on the drummer's shoulder. We're like, man, that band's got a good time. They sound tight. That drummer's good. That falls on all of us equally. Even Noah, he doesn't play any drums, but he's still part of the... He's often playing bass. There's this, like, thing where we all are now just a little bit more responsible for not only the sounds we're making, but the time we're keeping.
Okay.
Normally only one member of the band or two. Maybe you could argue the bass player and the drummer are sort of the clocks in the band. But we all have to be the clocks. And, like... So that's just the fundamental. I mean, the stuff I was talking about a few minutes ago was, like, all the trimmings, the things on top, like, the production elements, the, like, synthesizers and guitars and that. But the bedrock is even just democratic. Everything. So that's another thread that I think.
I got you.
Democracy in arrangement.
Well, it's kind of an interesting theory for a band.
It could be a book title, yeah. Democracy in Arrangement. Yeah.
So then not just as far as the individual songs, then, but since that's your process... for the individual songs, and since this new release was very thematic, and not only very thematic, but two times very thematic, you know, how did you guys, using that sort of individual to group writing process, you know, hold that together, and how did you decide originally that's what you wanted to do, and then how did you fit the songs into them? Did you already have a couple... And then decide on the theme, or was it the theme and then...
Well, the themes were... the themes came out of actually the process of sequencing our last record. We were throwing about around a bunch of different sequences for Would Things Be Different, and it was really challenging to find, like, what's the flow? There's 11 tracks here. How do they make sense together? What's the puzzle, you know? And... we were staying at my cousin's in Tennessee one night, and I, like, suddenly had this idea. I was, like, falling asleep, and I was like, they should be two EPs, and it should be Unravel, Bells and Whistles, Halcyon Days. Like, I had them in my head. I was like, it should be two EPs, because there's this flavor, and then there's Not Again, and there's Here I Am, and there's The Hush, and there's, you know, these two really, really different textures. And it wasn't right for that project at all. And ultimately, I think we came up with a sequence that really makes sense, where those 11 tracks do go together really well. But the seed had sort of been planted, and we were all into it. And so we never, like I said earlier, like the idea of assigning these colors was our attempt at creating a box, but making the walls of the box kind of like self-determining, you know? It was a little bit like, hey.
Hi.
We're doing an interview.
You
in? Yeah, but it's we're just
that's all good. Don't worry.
We'll be like, hey. we'll be over in 5 seconds.
Oh, yes.
Hi.
We're going to say hi.
Anyway. So we all were into it, and then started writing towards it. Without saying no. Like, I don't think there was ever a moment where we were like, that's not yellow enough. No, that's not gold enough. Like, we didn't do that. We let, you know, each other sort of decide, oh, this is my offering for this record, or my two songs, or whatever it was. And then we're very explicit with our producer about what we wanted the tone of each of them to be, and then, you know, had a lot of confidence in him being behind the steering wheel, and I mean, truly, this was the first record where, like, enormous parts of it were written in the actual studio. We'd never done that before. Everything that we had recorded before this had been toured extensively. We had figured out all the little ins and outs. And this was this, something where we actually came to, you know, day one, okay, we're tracking Only Skin. Here's how the piano goes. That's all I know. You know, actually, I think Only Skin was one that we had played before. But still, we entered, like, each one was sort of tabula rasa when we came in. And I think that was really great because it allowed the creative process to be just extremely focused. But also still, like James was saying, very democratic. Everybody has a hand. Like, I don't even remember who recorded probably 95% of the album. Like, I know it was the three of us.
Right.
You know, and some
but
friends.
But who exactly was playing what?
But who was playing what? Like, I actually probably couldn't tell you. So it.
Well, that screws me for my album review because I have some questions.
No. The credits are James James wrote it all down. It's in the liner notes and stuff. And it took some series going back and being like, oh yeah, we did put whatever Omnicord on this. Wow, weird, you know? Or like, you know, we sat down to do the drums in Chicago, and Danny also, our producer, knows that we're all multi-instrumentalists and knows that he knows our limits or lack of limits even better than we do. And I remember for Chicago, he was like, Heather, why don't you track some drums for this? And I was like, I don't know. I can't sit at a drum. Because I can play snare and I can play tom and I can play piano at the same time and sing at the same time. But you get me
behind
a kit.
Which is quite a talent, let me tell you. It's pretty amazing.
But you get me behind a kit and I'm like, fuck this. I don't know how. And I freaked out. And Danny was like, no, you just try. Let's do it. Why not? Let's spend an hour. Let's see what you come up with. And I was like, okay, but I can't sit at a normal. And he was like, here's a mallet. Here's this. And I had this, like, crazy fort of drums. And he just started playing the track. And I would go through it and just do, like, follow my instincts. And I had no confidence in myself. But Danny was like, just do it. Follow my instincts. We'd go back through and he'd be like, okay, I really liked what you did from this time to this time. Let's listen to that. Do that for this whole first verse. So he was very encouraging of, you know, the sort of outside the box thinking that we already do on our own. He really adapted that philosophy that we take in our live show to our approaches in the studio, which I think was really, really, which was incredibly inspiring and eye-opening. So the way that, you know, the way that this record actually came to be and actually was put down on, you know, recorded tape, not really, but fake tape, you know, was very consistent, I think, with what has become sort of our values as a band, which are very democratic.
Okay.
Yeah.
What she said.
Yeah.
Well, that's the democratic way.
Yeah,
one person says something and everybody else agrees, right? Yeah.
That's
how U.S. Congress works.
Yeah, I have to blow my nose over here in a corner.
You do that.
Sorry, no.
Okay, well, I want to get wrapped up here. Not too much longer.
Okay.
I don't want to keep you guys forever. But I did want to just ask, since, you know, you do have the new album out, if each one of you could just maybe discuss one of the songs that you contributed, and I'll let you choose. But just, you know, something about its meaning to you and why you felt it was important to have it on this project and what you think about it, you know, anything like that. I'll leave it up to you completely freeform, so say it however you want, but...
Sure. I mean, we all got to write our little portion. It worked out pretty evenly mathematically.
You are democratic, so...
Yeah, that's true. That's further more proof. I don't know. I think I wrote more songs on this record than I've ever written about traveling life, about, like, you know, like, you know, dealing with the comings and goings of life as a traveler.
Mm-hmm.
So the point of view of the, you know, four tunes that I've got on the double EP, or from the point of view of a person constantly in transit, and that. Is probably a pretty good way to identify these more modern tunes that I've been writing for the standards. It's been that vibe. The you know, my voice is from a person whose roots are uplifted constantly. That tune Heavy Home has a big a big echo of that, I'd say. I'm
you know, without talking to one song specifically, I think all the songs that I mean, if we're talking about that, or wrote and sort of, subject matter wise, they were all dealing with similar things. I mean, they were all dealing with losing love, yearning for love, and then finding love. And they were all sort of written in that order through a process I was personally going through. So. I just wrote that, and then so in this album, the songs that I wrote are, they're a journey of what I was going through at the time, you know? That's me. That's something I just, like, sort of realized in the moment right now.
I sort of missed the question because I was blowing my nose.
That's perfectly fine.
I think I can answer. Based on
it was like.
Oh, just answer any question you want.
Yeah.
It's the last one anyway,
I don't
so.
Know your song, well, you know, something, you know,
Heather,
song
interview you yourself. This is an opportunity I don't give anybody.
I can say that one of the most exciting things for me about this record was I've had the drum beat for Unmarked Pill in my head and in my brain, in my creative brain for years now, since like 2009. And to get to manifest something that you've been sort of milling over for that long was like so satisfying. And to have the support of my band to be like, let's fucking go for this. This song's gonna be crazy and unlike anything we've ever done before. But let's fucking go, balls to the wall. Why would we hold back? Even though it's not like anything else we've ever done, why would we stop at an 8 when we can go to 10? Like, and that was so awesome and affirming, and I'm so grateful to be in a band with people that are willing to say yes to something like that.
No!
And it's also just neat to see something through, you know? To, like, I think I dreamed that drum beat. I think I did. I have a few things that I've written that I've actually dreamed. I think that was one of them. And
I've dreamed short stories before, so I know what you're talking about.
And it's just really awesome to be able to see something through from start to finish like that. So, and I think that's kind of a bigger theme for this whole record, you know, to have, like, this idea that started so long ago become something that we all just jumped into together and to see it through. Is just awesome. So I'm really, really proud of the record, and I'm proud of us for doing it.
Awesome. Well, it is definitely a very entertaining and most of all very interesting record.
Thanks.
Honestly, I love records that I have a hard time wrapping my head around, and there's a reason I haven't written your review yet, and I'm just trying to come up with a way to frame it because it is such a complex work.
Thanks.
So that's a very good thing. So.
Thanks.
Congratulations on the new release.
Thanks.
Thank you for coming back to Cleveland. We're looking forward to the show.
Woo.
And thank you very much to all the members of the Spring Sets. I can't even say your name. The Spring Standards for joining us here on No Surf Music's Burning River Fireside Chat. So thanks again, everybody. We'll see you inside. And thanks to all of our listeners. This has been Burning River Fireside Chats with your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond. Again, thanks to James, Heather, and our mute New York Yankees fan, Noah. All right, goodbye.
Bye.
This has been a No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chat. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond, signing off. Remember, No Surf Music is your source for the best in Americana, alt country, indie rock, and more. For original reviews and interviews, visit nosurfmusic.com.